Good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. Thanks for joining us for another virtual event. And we're really happy to have Angie Kim with us today. She's going to be talking about her brand new book, Happiness Falls. And Chris Bojalian.
Chris. Always go with Chris.
Chris Grisham, as he says, is our special guest today. And he's going to be talking to Angie and Barbara. And as always, if you have questions for any of them, go ahead and put them in the chat function on YouTube or Facebook, and I'll be happy to ask any questions you might have. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you, Patrick. Did you say you were putting a buy link in the comments field?
No.
My attention wandered briefly.
So did mine. I think I did, but if not, I am going to put a buy link for signed copies, which we expect very soon of Happiness Falls.
Great. All right. Well, thank you. Well, today actually is the publication day for Happiness Falls. So, Angie, a toast to you. Chris, I know you have a glass of something, so you can raise it. Yes, here we all are going, yay, it's publication day. So very excited.
Cheers. Salute.
So this is the book launch for Angie's second book, following her Edgar-winning marvelous first book, which we also discussed and which she also signed for us, called Miracle Creek. And Chris made his first appearance at the Poison Pen in 100 degree heat, whatever it was, last May or June. And I told him that, you know, he had it easy. That was sort of a cool spell because it was 119 much of the summer. But anyway, he's safely at home, so it won't be a problem.
Hi, Barbara. Hi, Angie.
Sorry?
Chris. Hello, Barbara. Hello, Angie.
And here's Chris's, and this is the book that Chris was at your bookstore for, right?
That's right, The Lioness. It was wonderful.
Thanks, Angie.
Anyway, before we launch into conversation about Happiness Falls, Angie has signed our books. They are en route from Angie to the Poison Pen, but she has kindly included this wonderful thing, which will come with all of our copies. You want to show it?
Yeah, look at this beautiful double-sided print. It says, sometimes the answer lies in what's unsaid. And here's the beautiful cover image. And this is going to come with all of your orders, which are signed. Yay.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much. That was thoughtful of you to include it. So one of the things I think is an interesting, there are always these little trends that come up in publishing. And one of them, and that's not to say that Angie's just following a trend, because far from it, but there have been in recent books a number of people who are neurodivergent in one way or another. And in Angie's case, which is crucial to the plot, there is something called Angelman syndrome. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Okay, Angelman syndrome. So since the Mayo Clinic is a big presence here in Scottsdale, they're my go-to place for looking up medical terms. So I'm just going to briefly read it before Chris starts asking his penetrating, incisive, and illuminating questions. Do I have all that right, Chris Grisham? Was that what you're going to do?
You do. Absolutely, Barbara.
Okay, so Angelman syndrome is the genetic disorder. It causes delayed development, problems with speech and balance, intellectual disability, and sometimes seizures. People with Angelman syndrome often smile and laugh frequently and have happy, excitable personalities. And there are, if you look it up, there's some lovely photos of children with, you know, happy, smiling faces and so forth. What I think is wonderful is that medicine is working very hard on ways to repair genetic disorders if they can, by all kinds of techniques. So, you know, you have to hope that something as rare as Angelman's eventually will get some kind of a cure. But so it's just part of Angie's book. But anyway, being Angie, she's got a whole mix of things going on here in Happiness Falls. So Chris, what would you like to ask Angie?
Thanks, Barbara. Angie, good evening. Great to see you. So we're going to talk a lot about Happiness Falls because I devoured this novel, but it's not a thriller. It's a mystery. It is a beautifully written, unbelievably poignant, riveting, page-turning mystery. The book begins when Dad doesn't come home and one of his three kids does, covered in blood. And we are off, and we've got three amazing teenagers who we're going to want to talk about. But here's my first question, and it is deeply personal. Your author's note. talks about the fact that your middle school years in the United States were a emotional dumpster fire. So were mine. It's in your author's notes, so I'm not telling stories out of school, but talk a little bit about why having a dumpster fire of an adolescence leads to being a novelist. Because you and I are not alone. There are so many friends of mine who are writers whose adolescence were tragic.
Well, it's great fodder for everything, right? Okay, before I answer that, I have to say thank you. Barbara, you and the Poison Men have been such a great friend. Thank you so much for hosting me. This is my virtual launch event. This is my first event for Happiness Falls. This, you know, second novel, which is a big thing, right? Especially, Chris, you know, because you read a partial draft of this 2 years ago, 3 years ago, something like that. It's been a lot of stress and anxiety. And so thank you so much for helping me celebrate tonight. Chris, I am so in awe of you and everything you do. I loved your last book. Your Midwives was a book that I cited in my query to my agent as a book that I hoped that my own books might be compared to. And so to have you sitting here next to me, I am just floored by your generosity in reading and being with me. Thank you so much to both of you. I really am so excited that I'm here with you. This means a lot to me. So thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome. But see, Angie, here's where our careers are really different. You made the unbelievable mistake of writing a fantastic, beautiful, powerful first novel, Miracle Creek, won an Edgar Award. My gosh, it's a great book. That's a big mistake. You're talking about the stress of the second book. I felt none of that stress because my first book is the single worst first novel ever published, bar none. But back to you. I want to talk about the connection between crappy adolescents and great novelists.
Yes. Okay. So the answer, yes. So I moved from Korea to the US, to the Baltimore area as a teenager. As a preteen, as an 11-year-old in middle school. And it was really interesting because what I expected is just like amazing dream come true. And in some ways it was, in an objective way it was. So in Korea, my parents and I were extremely poor. We didn't have indoor plumbing. We barely had heat. I had never seen a color TV before. And so when we found out that we were moving to the US, people said, it's like you won the lottery. And, you know, and we were really excited. And I came to the US and I lived with my aunt and uncle. And indeed, it was like that. It was like, in an objective sense, everything that I had was everything that I had longed for or didn't even long for, because I didn't even know that that was possible. We had showers for the first time. I had a bed. I had a bedroom of my own. I had a refrigerator, a TV, like all of these things that I didn't even know existed. And so it was amazing. And yet at the same time, I had never been so miserable. And I think at the heart of that was that I lost my ability to communicate. So I couldn't speak. I couldn't speak English and I couldn't understand at first, but I, you know, learned to understand pretty quickly. But it took a long time for me to actually be able to speak and to lose my accent and to pick up the grammar and syntax and all of that sort of stuff. And what happened was that I felt stupid overnight. And I didn't realize until then, but oral fluency is something that we in our society equate with intelligence. And I myself felt that way also. And so because I couldn't communicate, I felt stupid. And I, And then once I learned enough English so that I could understand, I realized that other people indeed felt the same way about me because they were making fun of me in front of me, not realizing that I could actually understand them because I couldn't speak very well. And so it was a humiliating experience. It was a traumatizing experience. It's something that stayed with me, and I'm over 50 years old and I still feel that shame whenever I think back to it. And it's a really painful thing. And I think this is the thing that made it so that I really empathize deeply with people who can't speak for whatever that reason may be.
Which brings us to Eugene. And Eugene is one of, okay, viewers. Eugene is one of three teenagers in this book, and we're going to talk about it as a police procedural in a moment, but let's focus on Eugene and what Eugene cannot do and Angie's adolescence in the United States.
Yeah, so Eugene cannot speak. He has Angelman syndrome, as Barbara talked about in the beginning, and she read the Mayo Clinic's explanation. And he is a 14-year-old boy. He is biracial. The family's biracial, Korean American. And he can't speak. He also has motor difficulties, and he has a dual diagnosis of autism and something called mosaic Angelman syndrome. So kind of a more mild form of Angelman syndrome, where half of the genes in his body have this Angelman mutation and some don't. Who even knew that there was something like mosaicism, which I didn't even know about, which is so fascinating. And so he can't speak. And so even if he knows what happened to his father when he goes missing at the beginning of the book, which, you know, he's the only person who might know what happened to the father because he was with him when this occurred, he can't tell the family or the police what happened. And so in order to solve this mystery of what happened to the father, the family really does have to learn how to communicate and connect deeply with Eugene.
How Alfred Hitchcock-esque is this wonderful premise, and one of the many reasons why you will devour Happiness Falls. The only witness to the disappearance can't speak. And a lot of people around him presume that he can't understand or even communicate what he may or may not know. Now, this book is kind of a police procedural, but the principal police officer is Mia. Would you talk a little bit about, you know, the oldest of the, not the oldest, the second oldest of the three siblings? And
no,
I mean, I love her.
She's old. Oh, she's older than John.
She's older than John. She's older than John.
Like 2 minutes or something. Yeah.
Yes. No. Sorry, I had it backwards.
It's okay. Chris, I love that you said that it's a kind of a procedural, but Mia is like I hadn't really thought of it in that way in my own mind. I thought you were going to be talking about.
Okay, I'm dropping the mic. I'm done.
Janice. No. That's awesome. I love this. Okay, yeah, but it is true. Mia is, well, the whole family, the Mia and John, her twin, they're both 20 and they're home from college because it is, you know, 2020. It's the setting kind of has pandemic elements to it. It's not a pandemic novel, I don't think, but not at all, right? But it happens to be, you know, set during the pandemic. And then, and the mom, who is a Korean PhD in linguistics, whom I love, and she is, so the three of them are working together sort of with, kind of against the police and their lawyer that they eventually have to get to protect Eugene from the police. And you're right, Chris, that she really does, because she's our narrator. So she's the one who is kind of, you know, supervising everything, if you will, and sort of saying, okay, here are the different strands of the investigation. the police are looking into all of the things, you know, eyewitnesses who may have been there at the park when where the dad was last was when he disappeared and all of that sort of stuff. And she herself is really focused on some of the things that they find in the dad's computer and, you know, phone that they eventually recover from the park, from the river, and this mysterious notebook that they find that says HQ, which they realize has something to do with his happiness theory. So she's having to try to figure out what the dad means by all of that. And then there's John, who is really focusing in on Eugene and what is there any way that we can try to reach him and try to help him to communicate with us. So I love that you're thinking of Mia as the person who is sort of spearheading all of this.
So well, there are so many riveting red herrings. I've been doing this since the Mesozoic era. And I did not ever solve this mystery until, you know, you get to the end of the book. It's so satisfying, but so are the characters, which is what makes it such a special book for this particular story, where you're more focused on narrative momentum or character development.
Definitely the character development. I actually didn't think of this book as a mystery really until I was halfway through it, I would say. Because to me, yes, there is a missing person at the core of it, but just because there's a missing person doesn't mean that it has to be a, that the mystery itself has to be the core element. To me, the mystery of the missing person was a way in, a hook for the reader, if you will. And to me, it's kind of, and it's the same way that I thought of the sort of whodunit of Who Set the Fire for my debut novel, Miracle Creek, which is using the mystery as a Trojan horse, as something that I know that people are interested in, you know, that readers like, I myself like, and to get myself focused on, you know, motivating myself to get my butt in gear and actually write this, because I actually didn't know the answer to the question, what happened to the father? And I loved him and I loved this family and I wanted to figure out the answer. And the only way that I was going to figure it out was by actually writing it and figuring it out. But I, to me, what's more interesting about some of these types of tragedies and emergencies that we have are not necessarily sort of the procedural what happens as a result of that, you know, as far as figuring out the mystery element and all of that, but more about, okay, what is the consequence to the characters? What are they going through? And how are they feeling? And what are the dynamics of the family that get tested and that get revealed as a result of this kind of trauma that happens? And that's, to me, what is most interesting about these types of emergencies and tragedies and accidents and crimes that occur, even more than solving the sort of whodunit or whydunit elements.
So many books about missing people are about missing women. I did a casual search of my library, and literally 99.9999999999% of all missing person books are about missing women.
Yeah.
You've got a missing man. Tell us about that. Why that decision?
I love that you talked about that. Thank you so much for bringing that up. Actually, there is a footnote. So there, just a warning to the readers that there are footnotes in this novel.
Oh, no, not a warning. This is not infinite jest footnotes that snow you under. These are really surprising, interesting, and few, but very interesting footnotes.
Yeah, few. And also some footnotes that the character herself, Mia, who is the first person narrator, she gives you on the second page permission to skip them. She actually says, listen, the way that my mind works, I sort of like think in like I all these side points like come and distract me, but and I know that there are some people who find those things annoying. And so if you find them annoying, just go ahead and skip them. It's okay. And so she gives you permission. So I think in a way she's actually being a little bit thoughtful and putting some of these side notes. And I think they're pretty funny. I think they're the most funny things about the novel, but anyway, they're in footnotes. So go ahead and skip them if you'd like. But in any case, she says in a footnote that she actually did do, just like you did, Chris, a casual sort of research into these missing person stories in TV, you know, movies, as well as literature. And she said, I forget what the number is. And it's actually something that I did in using a spreadsheet. And it's something like 87% or something like that of all of them involve girls or women. And I do think that there is this thing that we talk about a lot. In fact, I think you and I have talked about that, Chris, about, you know, it, when we're talking about things in our writing group and things like that, about how a lot of these women in peril types of stories. And it was important for me to kind of interrogate that and sort of say, why is that? And what happens if it is a man who's missing and a man who is not involved in, you know, kind of, the mafia or stories about, you know, like some kind of intelligence thriller, like espionage, because that's where some missing men do appear in those types of stories. And what if instead it's an ordinary man? What if instead it is an ordinary man in a domestic context? So Adam, the missing father here, is actually a stay-at-home father. He is the person who is responsible for the kids, who does the grocery shopping, who does the cooking, who is driving the kids around to schools, and who is driving Eugene around to all of his therapies. And when something like that happens and a man goes missing, are the police going to say, as often happens when it's the stay-at-home mom who's missing, oh, well, maybe she kind of went a little crazy from the trauma and the pressure of it all, and she decided to just leave her family behind. Is that going to be a factor in the same way? I was curious. And so I wanted to find out. So that's one of the things that I wanted to think about, is what is the response going to be? And also, what is going to happen to the family as a result of this anchor, who does happen to be a man, but still he is the anchor of the family, who's taking care of everybody, who notices everything, becoming missing. When that happens, who's going to even notice that he's missing? Because he's the one who is supposed to do all the noticing of all the familial things, all the domestic things.
Chris, just give me a moment. Let me ask a question. I think when we say missing person, do you think that there is an assumption that it's at least a teenager, if not an adult? I mean, we really don't talk about missing children in the same way. We don't assume that missing children went missing voluntarily. You know, so no. If a child goes missing, everybody gets alarmed. If it's an older person, whether, you know, define the bottom line, whatever it might is, then those assumptions about, you know, maybe it was voluntary, or maybe, you know, they just wanted to leave home, or maybe they decided to go on a spree or something, comes into play. So, you know, I'm wondering if we distinguish in all of these kinds of situations between missing child and missing person. Do you think?
And I do think that, I mean, you know, aside from runaway situations, like with teenagers and stuff like that, you know, in middle school, and when we have missing persons, there is kind of like a, you know, is it possible that this teenager or preteen was upset with a parent and kind of ran away from home? So you do call all the friends and all of that sort of stuff. But Mia actually talks about that in, I think, another footnote, or maybe maybe it's in the text itself. But she does talk about the fact that, you know, when it is somebody who is more likely to be in peril, and that is usually defined to be a child or a woman who is maybe not considered as strong and as capable physically as a man, then we do make these assumptions about, yeah, they must be in peril, versus when it's a man, then, you know, thinking about things like, did he run away with a woman? Is there an affair going on here? And there is indeed a mysterious woman and mysterious notes and voicemails and things like that that come up. So, you know, so, and it's really interesting, you know, that one of the things that comes up always in missing person cases is, how well did we know the person who went missing?
Exactly. It becomes an investigation, really, of the, you know, the real investigation is into the person who's missing more than it is in order to gain any understanding of the circumstances and so forth. And, you know, I find that that's why there are a lot of crime novels that start with a missing person, you know, or, you know, not a missing person, but another way this can work is, you know, there are two people side by side in an airplane or something, and it goes down and nobody knows why the two people were together, you know. So, so basically, the crime part often arises from investigating who the person was before the person went missing or died.
Right, which is why it may not even be a crime story at all, right? Yeah. And that is the thing about missing person cases. And that's one of the things that I love about writing this and why I wanted this to be a missing person story is because it is so wide open. And, you know, Mia makes the point that, Chrissy, you're going like, so yeah, chime in if you'd like, but Mia makes the point that there are in missing person mysteries are often the deepest mysteries, the most confounding, the most frustrating, because they're the most open-ended, because the possibilities are endless. At least in the homicide, you know that, you know, like there was a death. In a missing person case, you have no idea. It could be that the person just decided to take a vacation and forgot to tell everyone, which did happen actually in a book that I read like 2 years ago, and it really annoyed me. But anyway, the dog literally ate the note to the family. So if you guys know what book I'm talking about, don't say anything, because I don't want to piss off this author. But, you know, stuff like that can happen. Or it could be that they were horribly, you know, they were kidnapped and tortured and mutilated, like the most horrific thing could have happened. So that whole spectrum of things is open, and we don't even know what we're talking about, let alone who did it or how it was done or why it was done. So I feel like that the fact that it's so open out there is what makes missing person mysteries the most sort of intriguing, and also for the in real life, though, the most frustrating to live through.
Your first sentence is fantastic. Those are second. But when you read the first two sentences together, you get really precisely at the notion of narrative drive, missing person, and all of that core element, who is Mia, who is this family character stuff. Do you have the book handy? Would you read the first two sentences?
Yeah, I do have the book. Okay.
So imagine.
I know, right?
Does the first two.
Yeah, so the first sentence, okay. So the first two sentences are, we didn't call the police right away. Later, I would blame myself. Wonder if things might have turned out differently if I hadn't shrugged it off. Insisting Dad wasn't missing, but just delayed, probably still in the woods looking for Eugene, thinking he'd run off somewhere.
That gets at one of the reasons why I adore this book, the pervasive sense of dread, as the four people who are still at the home are trying to simultaneously have a semblance of normality and find Dad. Now, you said earlier, you have no idea what's happening to Dad when you start the book. But did you have a sense of who the family was?
I did have a sense of who the family was, because the family is a family that has been with me since I actually started writing early in my 40s in 2010 is when I first started writing stories about this particular family. So one of the first stories that I ever, a short story that I wrote about in general was about this family. And it was published in 2013, and it was published right before I started working on Miracle Creek. And this family has actually been with me ever since. I really love Mia, who is the narrator, and the short story that I wrote was in her voice. And she's funny, and she has a dry wit. She's very sarcastic. She's kind of annoying. No. I hope she grows on you.
Yes, she does. she does. She's great.
Yeah, no, I love her. I love her. But she does. She says, look, you know, I know that I'm annoying to a lot of people, and I'm working on that. I really am. And, you know, and she recognizes her flaws, which is why I think, you know, she's lovable. But I really loved her voice. And so when I was writing Miracle Creek, for example, I actually thought, maybe I'll have Mia and John from that short story that I wrote. Maybe I'll have them be kind of the grown-up investigators. And this Miracle Creek explosion of this hyperbaric chamber is the first thing that they investigate. And I actually have like scenes that I wrote from Mia's voice in, you know, investigating Miracle Creek, and it didn't quite work. And so I was like, all right, I'm not doing that. But they just kept on coming back to me. Whenever I would hear about things that's going on in the sort of autism world, because their little brother, Eugene, I always knew had autism and was non-speaking, I would think to myself, I wonder if this family tried that with Eugene, almost as if they were a real family, even though they weren't, obviously. Yeah. And I think to myself, like in the short story that I wrote, they were in Korea. And John and Mia were, twins. They were much younger, and they were kind of running around this Korean graveyard trying to literally find Eugene's voice, because he's not a non-speaker, in the ground near their grandparents' graveyard. And it's a magic realism story. Mm. And they didn't really succeed. It's kind of ambiguous, the ending, but you know, you obviously get at the beginning of Happiness Falls that because Eugene is still a non-speaker, that they didn't really succeed. And so I would always wonder what was happening with them. And then in real life, in my life, I learned about a bunch of my friends' children who were diagnosed with so-called nonverbal autism, who couldn't speak, who we had all, their parents, their doctors, their therapists, you know, their teachers, everybody had assumed that they had severe cognitive deficits and that they didn't have words. They truly were nonverbal, and they couldn't read, they couldn't understand, and they couldn't really think in words. And then my friends started doing this spelling therapy with them using a spelling board. And since we're on YouTube and we have video, I will show you. This has been taped to my wall for so long. This is the kind of letter board that gets like sort of held up in front of them. And then they would learn, because they have motor difficulties, to point to letters one by one, very painstaking, very tiring and very slow process, but to actually move their own hands and fingers to each letter and spell. And that's how they learned to communicate. And when they did that, these friends of mine, they found out that their children that they had always thought didn't have thoughts inside them did. And they knew how to spell, they knew how to read, and they had all these beautiful thoughts that spilled out of them. And when I saw that in person for the first time, it just kind of broke me. And I just thought, I have to write about this. I have to, and I thought, I have to write about this. And this, somehow this has happened. And it's happened to Mia and John and Eugene's, you know, and I don't know exactly how, but they're going to discover this for Eugene. And so that's how the story was born. Yeah.
readers are going to talk a lot about Mia, narrator, Eugene, Angelman, but I love John too. Talk a little about John, the third of these remarkable teens.
John is, I love John so much. He is a feminist. He has a high emotional quotient, much more so than Mia, I think. He is very sensitive. Yeah. He is kind of like the joy of the family. He like is an optimist. He looks at everything on the bright side. He is a fierce protector of Eugene. He did something, and this is something that is not really in the novel. I allude to it. It's in the short story that I wrote. He did something when the mom was pregnant with Eugene that he feels deep guilt and shame for, that he thinks caused Eugene to have a genetic anomaly. And so he feels really guilty about that. And so he has kind of devoted his life to like Eugene's care. He's a fierce protector. Mia is too, but he works at the therapy center where Eugene goes to receive speech therapy and occupational therapy and, you know, physical therapy and all of these types of things. And it is just kind of wonderful that he really is interested in psychology and sociology, and he wants to be sort of a social worker and he wants to help. And so what's great about Mia and John is that they are sort of the typical siblings that, you know, were once inseparable, as, you know, twins can be yeah. when they're little. And now they're in college and they kind of get annoyed by each other, and they think, you know, they kind of have these stupid, silly spats and stuff. But he has such a good heart, and he is such an optimist, and he really wants to protect his mother too, which is and Eugene. And that is really interesting, because when, by virtue of him wanting to protect the mom, you know, it's very kind of cool, because Mia kind of comes to him and says, you know, we have to tell mom everything, and you cannot like try to protect mom, you're being paternalistic. And he just gets very wounded by that. So it's really interesting, the
it is
between them. Yeah.
Would you talk about the title?
Oh God. The title. Okay. Chris, when you first read it, it was Happiness Quotient, right?
Correct. Yes.
You didn't really like Happiness Quotient, right? Did you?
No, I did not.
Yeah. You did like
it. I like Happiness Falls.
You do? Okay. So a lot of people didn't love Happiness Quotient. I it's like Miracle Creek. Miracle Creek was originally called Miracle Submarine. And I happen to like that. My editor, when I told David Ebershoff that, he was like, I'm so glad that you changed the title to Miracle Creek. And I think he feels the same way about Happiness Falls. So it used to be called Happiness Quotient because that is an equation / theory that the dad has about happiness being relative. And in order to measure happiness correctly, you have to kind of divide your experience by your expectations or your baseline of your life. And thus the quotient because of the division. So my publication team kind of said, especially my publicist and my marketing team said, you know, and sales, happiness quotient, like, do people really know what quotient means? It's kind of a weird word. It sounds very sciencey, can turn people off. And they also thought that it sounded really nonfiction-y, like Happiness Project or something. And, you know, like, which is a nonfiction, very popular kind of thing. And so we went around and around and around. And finally, we came up with Happiness Falls. And the falls has several different meanings. So falls, you know, can mean that the happiness level is falling, right? Which certainly would happen with a tragedy and an emergency. There are waterfalls in the novel itself. So that is obviously something that is one of the meanings as well. And then there's fall, like a person can fall. Like in the first chapter, Eugene comes home, he is running, and which is, first of all, a very surprising thing because he has motor issues. So the fact that he can run is actually making Mia like extremely proud and happy. And then she, and then he comes to her and he pushes her and she falls down. And so there's that kind of a fall as well. And then of course, expectations and all of that. So there are lots of different meanings. So I think that's one of the reasons why we all kind of, as soon as it was my UK editor who first came up with it, we all were like, that might be a good title. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There are Easter eggs hidden in this book that Miracle Creek devotees might discover. In the same way that I'm learning tonight that there's this 2013 short story with Mia and John and Eugene in utero. We don't want to reveal those in this Zoom, but what is it like to build this world a la George Martin, where the books have got these Easter eggs?
I love Easter eggs. Chris, do you like those types of things too in your worlds when you kind of like mix them together?
Because I don't dislike doing, but I've never done it. But I don't dislike doing it. No.
Yeah, because I really liked it. So to me, Miracle Creek and Happiness Falls are kind of companion novels. They're not, you don't need to have read one for the other at all. They're not at all sequels or related stories or anything like that. But I do consider them companion novels in a couple of ways, in the way that they're kind of flip sides of the same coin. So in the same way that Miracle Creek sort of talked about parenting sacrifices, in terms of medical outsiders and as well as cultural and linguistic outsiders as far as immigrants are concerned, but really focusing in on the parents and how they're feeling. This novel really focuses on the siblings and on also on Eugene, the child with the medical issues, at more directly. And so we hear more directly from those experiences and those perspectives. And so to me, that was one aspect of it. And another one is that it does take place in the same world geographically. They both take place in the Northern Virginia area. And, you know, there are definitely some of the same characters who are making tiny little appearances. And at the end of Miracle Creek, there is a place, a therapy center called Henry's House that becomes established. And Eugene is goes to Henry's House. This is about 10, 12 years later now in Happiness Falls. And so he goes there and he meets some of our old friends from Miracle Creek, and they don't really make appearances, but the characters talk about them. And there's a very, very brief scene with one of the characters named Teresa. And we hear a little bit about Young and the Yus, the Korean immigrant family that was in Miracle Creek. And I just love that because I just think it's just really fun.
And yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah, I love that. But I will tell you that my, my film and TV agent was like, they weren't all that pleased about it because, you know, as you know, probably, Chris, I'm sure you know that when film TV rights people buy something, they're buying the rights to the characters. So they didn't like the fact that there were some character like reappearances. Some characters who made repeat appearances in this novel. And so we had to sort of carve them out and all that kind of contractual nonsense stuff. So that was kind of a little bit of a headache, but I think worth it.
Okay, since you're talking about the movie stuff, spill more.
spill more. So there isn't really much that I can say about Happiness Falls because we haven't really submitted it. My agents are actually—
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I was getting the impression that there was a deal you could announce. I'm sorry.
No. There's no announcement, but there is a deal for Miracle Creek, which it hasn't been announced, but because we're waiting for the, you know, like, stars
strikes to end. Yeah, I know that. Yeah.
But there Many are, strikes. But the, yeah, no, there are people and there are actually like roles that are cast and whatever. So it's really, really fun, but I am really hoping. And there's an amazing script that I just like started crying when I read the pilot script. So I'm really, really excited.
Oh, so pilot. So we're talking a mini series, not a film.
Yes. A limited series. Yeah. A limited series for Miracle Creek. So really, really excited and, you know, very, very much am supporting the strike, but also really, really hoping that that strike is over so that we can get going. And I'm very, very excited. Yeah. Because everything's kind of on standstill right now, I think.
When I was in Los Angeles 2 weeks ago.
And?
On meetings, of course, even the hoteliers were on strike.
Right.
So I'd be leaving the hotel to go to these meetings that I had, and I would be megaphoned. And finally, I just said, look, I'm a writer too. I'm with you in spirit. And they said, well, we're the hoteliers. I said, no, I know that. I just mean that my industry's on strike too. Okay.
Very interesting time, isn't it? You know, bookstores are unionizing and just all kinds of, you know, the world's in a lot of ferment at the moment, and people are trying to, in part, make sense of it, you know, by joining together or trying to pursue a goal. It's very interesting. Yeah. I have one question before we call up Patrick, and I'm indebted to Graham Norton, the wonderful Irish. I did a conversation with him last week, and I cheated by watching somebody else interview, so I can't take credit for this, but I thought it was great, so I just stole it and used it anyway. But the question arose about how he writes his books, you know, because he's doing all these other things. And his answer, I thought, was fascinating. So I'd be interested to know what you think. He starts by imagining with a situation. He thinks of some situation. And from that, he begins to people it. So first we have the situation, then he gets the characters, and then eventually a story ensues. That's his process. He's not writing crime. So, you know, while there is a plot, the plot isn't necessarily going to be central to what he's doing. But I think, Chris, you know, because you've written so many books that are really quite different, how's it work for you?
Just like Graham, premise. I begin with a premise, then work backwards. Alcoholic flight attendant wakes up next to a dead body far from home. She's a blackout drunk and has no idea what happened. Hollywood's biggest star finally gets married and brings her entourage into the Serengeti on a honeymoon where it all goes to hell fast. First divorce in North America for domestic violence, 1662 Boston. What happens?
Got it. So yeah. I thought it made a lot of sense, and my mind would work that way. Angie, yeah. How does this work for you? People always want to know about process, so I'm anticipating.
I love process questions. Yeah. And I love process questions that Chris can answer because I want to learn from the master here. I'm such the, you know, so for me, for the two books, it was very different. So for Miracle Creek, it was premise. It was totally premise. It was HBOT, Oxygen Therapy Center, which is a world that I know very well, blows up. And the mom of one of the patients who was inside is on trial. And she's being blamed. And so did she really do it? So it was that kind of a premise thing, and everything else came from it. And I remember actually even like the thread of the immigrant parents, the immigrant business owners owning the oxygen tank that blew up, that actually came out because I was like, how am I gonna get these Korean people in there? Because I really want, this is my debut novel. It's my first thing that I'm writing. I don't think it's gonna be made into a novel at all. It's not really, I actually have a sign I'm looking at right in front of me that says, this is not a novel, that I had taped up in front of me the entire time I was writing it to remind myself, it's probably not gonna be made into a novel. Let's just experiment and not worry about it. And so for me, like even just the people that that world populated, that got populated, that story were just byproducts of the fact that I just wanted to tell certain types of stories. And I had like little short stories that I wanted to actually like insert into this frame of this premise and the plot. And for this one, for Happiness Falls, it was totally different because again, like I told you, I knew this family so well, and I wanted to tell some kind of story about the family. And I knew that it had to have something about happiness in it. And I actually thought that it was going to be like this warm, domestic, like family drama that had absolutely nothing to do with any kind of crime or missing person or mystery or anything. I thought maybe the dad was sick in the hospital, and he was really obsessed with happiness theories. And this very, very quirky family that I love so much wanted to do something to make him happy and give him hope. And so they were putting these elaborate family experiments about happiness on for their father to try to help him get his book published. That's how the whole Happiness Falls, you know, like book started. And then everything about the missing person mystery and everything like that came later.
This, you know, it's wonderful that talk to creative people. It's really interesting. I seem to have gotten something in my eye. I'm sorry, I've realized I've been rubbing, I've been eyelash or something. So but anyway, you know, I find it interesting that, you know, creativity works differently for almost every creator. And, you know, I also think very often that if it worked for you the first time, people stick with it. Although you're obviously, you know, doing something, changing it up some, but the real point is when people ask questions about process that none of it's transferable. It only is what works for you. But I do think that people are constantly interested in, and maybe it's partly to try to unleash their own creativity.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. And one of the things that I admire so much about you, Chris, is that you experiment so much. You tell the story in whatever way needs to be told, whatever genre and voice and style needs to be told in order to make that story work.
Thank you.
And I feel like you don't do the thing that some people do, which is to try to sort of stick to a very narrow, you know, defined field where you've had the most success or whatever, and you just sort of go out and but I can tell when it's a Chris Bojalian story because I mean, it's wonderful, but I don't know, I couldn't quite define it because it's so different and the genre is different. Sometimes it's horror, sometimes it's historical, sometimes it's not, like sometimes it's realistic and sometimes it's more crime, you know, mystery. You've done a courtroom drama. I mean, it's just, but and I admire that, and that's what I want to be. That's totally what I want
to
be.
Love it.
That's
Angie wants to grow up to be Chris. So you all here. I think it's great. Chris,
thank you, Angie.
Patrick, come and join us. But while Patrick's joining us, Chris, tell us about your book coming out in March. Just give us a quick preview.
Yes, please.
The Princess of Las Vegas.
Oh, look, a Hindi copy.
Imagine. A Princess Diana tribute show performer at Las Vegas's crappiest casino gets involved with Russian oligarchs, cryptocurrency, money laundering, and it all begins to come apart when it turns out, yes, the princess is fake, but the murders are real.
Wow. Well, I'm certainly hoping I'll have a chance to talk to you about it when we get to March.
I'd love that.
Oh, yeah. I'd love that.
We'll work that out. Meantime, Patrick, do we have any questions or reactions from the audience?
Well, first of all, Chris, that sounded like it must have been a fascinating book to research.
It was Princess Diana in Las Vegas. I was in heaven.
Cryptocurrency, the dark web, all sorts of fun stuff, right?
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. Your fellow author, May Cobb, is watching, and she's just saying that she's so thrilled about the autism representation
right
book.
We did a very a wonderful conversation with May, and she does have a child that has autism. I think I learned a lot in talking with her. And I think the more that we hear from people who are caregivers or actually maybe have autism and so forth, the more we learn and the less we're inclined to turn away.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm so thrilled because I teach, this is such an issue that has really, really caught me. And so I teach a bunch of non-speaking autistic children and adults, ages basically like around 13 to 25, creative writing to a bunch of them, some over Zoom and some in person. And I'm so excited that they're actually going to be featured on national TV. So I'm doing an all-day taping tomorrow at the therapy center where I teach creative writing. And the Juju Chang from GMA from ABC News, who announced Happiness Falls as a GMA pick today, she's going to be flying down tomorrow and she's going to be in conversation with me and filming my non-speaking creative writing students. And they're thrilled. I'm thrilled. I think it's going to be amazing. And they're going to be spelling and typing, you know, on TV and showing people what it is, how it is that they communicate. And I think that things like that, the more that we can challenge this assumption that we have as a society that oral fluency is equivalent to intelligence, which is something that I have been trying to fight all my life, I think the better it can be. So I'm really, really excited and proud about that aspect of it. Thank you.
Marvelous. Patrick, anything else?
Not really.
So erudite, we probably just blew them all away. A lot to take in. This is a very complicated conversation. And I think there's a lot for people to think about and reflect. Let me remind you that the video that you are watching also will become a podcast. And therefore, you can recommend either listening or watching it to anyone you know, because it stays posted on our website, poisonpen.com. And I love that these conversations keep attracting, you know, viewers and readers to surprising numbers. And anyway, it's been Zoom came along. It's just the magical moment. It was a terrible moment, but at the same time, without Zoom, I'm not sure how any of us would really have gotten through the pandemic years. It's created an international community much more than was able to exist before we had this great tool to work with. Patrick and I have spent a lot of time with authors that we would never have had conversations with, I think, before. So it's been remarkable. Angie, again, a toast to you on publication day. Thank you for sharing your virtual book launch with us. Chris, always a pleasure. I really will look forward to talking to you in March. And viewers, thank you for spending some time with us. Again, please do recommend to people that they watch this. And finally, we do have autographed copies of, and I forgot to say that this is our notable new fiction book of the month for September. So we're excited about that too. Here at the Poison Pen. Right. So good night, everybody. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Barbara. Thanks, Patrick. Thanks, Angie. Congratulations. Good night, world.
Thank you so much, guys. Thank you. Bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.